Chapter 28. Geoffrey checked his restraints. The Quaenor was burning fuel again, continuing with orbital insertion and approach rendezvous with the Winter Palace. Up in the forward command blister, the nearest thing the ship had to a bridge, Jemai and Mira Gilbert were tethered to either side of him, secured within a messy cat's cradle of bungee cords and buckle-on harnesses. The command blister was a metal-framed cupola, set with impact-resistant glass and furnished with quaintly old-fashioned controls and readouts. "Your family is still ahead of us," Gilbert said, confirming the news that Geoffrey had been half expecting. "We had some Delta V in reserve. Unfortunately, so did the Kinyeti." She tapped at the fold-down instrument panel, muttering some dark aquatic oath. Reaction motors popped and stuttered, finessing the Quaenor's course. "Going to be a nail-biter, I'm afraid. We'll meet them on the same orbit. Unfortunately, it looks like they'll make dock before we do." "How many docking slots?" Jemai asked. "Close-ups show one at either pole. Anyone's guess as to whether both are serviceable."
"Been a long while since there was any need for two ships to be docked at the same time," Geoffrey said. "If ever."
The Quaenor wasn't new. Geoffrey could tell that just from the rank mustiness of his living quarters, but he doubted that it dated from much before the turn of the century. Rather, it had been tailored to pan-ideological specifications, which dictated a strict minimum of org-generated contrivances. Glass windows, so that the universe might be apprehended photon by photon on its own blazing terms, rather than through layers of distorting mediation. Control and navigation systems that required physical interaction, so that a person had to be present in body as well as mind. Decision-making abdicated to fallible, slow-witted human pilots rather than suites of swift and tireless expert systems.
"What are Hector and Lucas hoping to gain here?" Jemai asked.
Geoffrey scratched a nugget of crystal-hard dust from his eye. The period of unconsciousness in the rocket hadn't done anything to take the edge off his exhaustion. "The cousins don't give two shits about what's inside the Winter Palace. Not for themselves, anyway. They just don't want me finding anything that might hurt Eunice's reputation or endanger the business." He adjusted one of the restraints where it was starting to chafe. "They'll be planning to scuttle it, one way or another. They already have the paperwork in place." Jemai asked,
"Reckon they brought bombs with them?" "Plenty of stuff in a ship that can be used to make a bang," Gilbert said. "That's before we even get to the fact that there's a whole other ship stuck inside the Winter Palace."
Geoffrey tensed at the arrival of a Qing request. It was Hector, and the Qing coordinates placed him near the moon.
"I don't think we have much to say to each other," he said, opting to keep the conversation strictly voice only.
"You took the call,"
Hector said,
his reply bouncing back from the Kinyeti almost immediately. "Which suggests you think there's something worth discussing."
"Is it just you, or did Lucas come along for the ride?"
"Only room for one of us, Geoffrey. I came up in a cargo shot, not the crewed capsule. Stress wouldn't have been good for Lucas, not after what he did to his leg."
He emitted a brief, humorless laugh.
"It was quite a trip. You should try it sometime."
"I did it once," Geoffrey said.
"Not this way. With no cushioning and the safety margins down to zero. The kick when I hit the bend at the base of the mountain. That was something. The view, though. Once the pusher lasers had me, I was sailing into orbit. Glorious."
"Glad it was worthwhile. You're brave or stupid, one of the two." Hector let slip another laugh.
"It's still not too late to make this good, Geoffrey. Whatever you think you're going to achieve in the Winter Palace, you don't have to go through with it."
"So I should just leave you to destroy it?"
"We have a good life here, cousin. Everything we need. Why are you so anxious to ruin things?"
"If Eunice wanted to screw the family, she had her whole life to do it."
"You have a touching faith in human nature. I'd say she's perfectly capable of screwing us from the afterlife, if that's what she wanted."
"Hector, trust my sister on this. Sunday knew Eunice inside out. Eunice didn't do pointless, spiteful gestures. And why the hell would she have something against us anyway?"
"She lost her mind, cousin. Out there, on the edge of the system. From that point on, she wasn't thinking straight."
"I don't think she lost her mind. I think she saw something out there, had some kind of experience, something that made her look back on everything she'd achieved up to that point
and realize it wasn't necessarily worth all the blood and toil she'd put into it. But that's not going mad. It's called getting a sense of perspective.
After an interval, Hector said,
Love to think you were right, but we can't take any chances here. Too much depends on us.
At least let me see what's inside the Winter Palace.
And if it's something that's going to hurt us? Something we can't recover from?
I'm not going to destroy the business, Geoffrey said, exhaustedly. I don't give enough of a damn about it.
And if we'd done something bad? Some crime only she knew about? If you found out that your own flesh and blood had done something unspeakable, could your conscience allow you to keep the secret then, cousin?
He imagined Hector shaking his head, tutting beneath his breath.
You wouldn't be able to live with that kind of secret.
Softly, Geoffrey asked, What kind of crime?
How the fuck should I know? Artilex, genetic weapons, who knows what she got up to 100 years ago? Who knows what anyone got up to back then?
This doesn't make any sense, Hector. We're almost talking like equals now. Why couldn't we have had this conversation weeks ago?
Hector sighed as if it bored him to have to explain something that should have been obvious.
Weeks ago, you were still family, Geoffrey. Now you're not. You've defected, turned traitor. Now you're a business adversary. Now you're an equal. That changes everything. I feel I can almost respect you.
Please turn around.
Kinyeti's locked on, cousin. I'd maintain a safe distance if I were you.
What are you planning?
What I came here to do, Hector said. Demolition.
Rather than completing its approach, the Kinyeti came to a station keeping halt 50 kilometers out, following almost the same orbit as the Winter Palace. Geoffrey wondered, optimistically, if Hector had had second thoughts. Perhaps, after all, he had begun to get through to his cousin, making him see sense. But no. After 10 minutes, a much smaller vehicle detached from the head of the mining ship and resumed the original approach vector. They studied the tiny, ball-shaped craft at high mag via the Quaenor's own cameras. It was the kind of short-range ship-to-ship ferry that could also serve as an escape capsule or single-use re-entry vehicle.
Should have seen this coming, Geoffrey said.
Hector doesn't want the Kinyeti's crew getting any closer to the Winter Palace than necessary. Still playing family secrets close to his chest.
Kinyeti is withdrawing,
Arethusa said, as the bigger ship fired a string of steering motors along its spine.
Guess they'll be returning to collect Hector, but for the moment, he's told them to keep the hell away.
They'll be paid well enough not to ask awkward questions, Geoffrey said.
Once he was on his way, it only took Hector 20 minutes to complete the crossing to the Winter Palace. Using the capsule's micro-thrusters, he executed one inspection pass, spiraling around the station's cylinder from end to end before closing in for final docking. If the Winter Palace had queried the little ship's approach authorization and then given clearance to commence final docking maneuvers, there was no practical way to intercept the tight-beamed comms traffic from the Quaenor. Geoffrey could only presume that they would be challenged on their own approach.
Sinking for dock, Gilbert said as Hector's ship went into a slow roll, matching the station's centrifugal spin rate.
Contact and capture in 5, 4, 3.
The capsule docked.
Clamped arms folded down to secure it. 2 or 3 minutes passed, and then there was an exhalation of silvery glitter from the airlock collar. A gasp of escaping pressure held there since the last time the lock was activated. And then the seals locked tight. The tiny capsule was almost lost in the details of the station's end cap docking and service structures.
Lining us up for the other pole, Gilbert said, tapping commands into one of the fold-down keypads.
Think we can pass through the entire structure?
It's just a big hollow tube with Winter Queen running down the middle. Geoffrey said,
we shouldn't have any problems, especially as Arethusa already chinged aboard not so long ago.
I only saw what she let me see, Arethusa warned.
Hector's transfer into the smaller ship had eaten into his lead over the Quaenor, but they were still 30 minutes from docking. Geoffrey drummed his fingertips, the seconds crawling by with agonizing slowness. He couldn't see Hector taking his time inside, no matter the novelty value of being able to roam at will through Eunice's private kingdom. They were 50 kilometers out when the first challenge came, shrill and automated, fully in keeping with Eunice's general policy of not extending a magnanimous welcome to visitors.
Unidentified vehicle on approach heading 119317. You do not have docking or flyby authorization. Please adjust your vector to comply with mandatory exclusion volume.
The voice, which was speaking in Swahili, could easily have passed for his grandmother's.
If you do not adjust your vector, we cannot be held responsible for any damage caused by our anti-collision systems.
Hold the course, Jeffrey said. Let her, it, no, we mean business. Eunice, are you listening to me?
I'm here, the construct said, deigning not to project a figment into what was already a cramped space.
Make yourself heard to everyone present, including Arethusa. No reason for them not to listen in on our conversation.
Sunday wouldn't like that.
Do it anyway. I'm ordering you. There was a barely measurable pause.
It's done. They can hear me now.
Good. Jeffrey looked around at his companions, trusting that they'd settle for asking questions later. I'm afraid there's no time to bring you up to speed right now, Eunice, but we need docking permission for the Winter Palace.
Tell it you're on Akinya business.
There was little point seeking the construct's guidance if he was not willing to give her suggestions the benefit of the doubt. Mira, am I patched through?
Say your piece,
Gilbert said. This is Jeffrey Akinya, grandson of Eunice. I'm aboard the deep space vehicle Quainor, requesting approach and docking authorization. He waited a moment. Then, for all that it sounded pompous, added, I am on important family business.
Approach approval has already been assigned to Hector Akinya. No further docking slots are available.
Jeffrey ground his teeth. Hector is docked at one pole. We can come in at the other.
No further docking slots are available,
the voice repeated, but this time with an edge of menace. I have the right to come in, Jeffrey said. Disarm your anti-collision systems and give me clearance for the unoccupied dock. You have no choice but to comply with a family instruction.
Your identity is not verified. Desist approach and adjust your vector. It doesn't believe you are you,
Eunice said. Jeffrey bit off a sarcastic response before it left his mouth. Why did it accept Hector and not me?
Hector came in on an Akinya vehicle, showing Akinya registration the same way Memphis would have done. The Winter Palace had no reason not to let him through.
He grimaced. Mira, can we fake a civil registration?
Not infallibly, not legally, and most certainly not now, given that the Habitat already has us pegged as being under different ownership.
Gilbert shot him an apologetic glance.
You're just going to have to talk your way through this one, Jeffrey. Even Jemai can't help us until we're docked.
Need some ideas here, Eunice, he said.
If the Habitat recognizes the notion of family visiting rights, if it grasps that Hector is an Akinya and it therefore has an obligation to let him dock, then it may be running something a little bit like me. Much less sophisticated, of course, but a model of Eunice all the same, and with an attempt at an embedded knowledge base.
All well and good, but I'm not sure that gets us anywhere, Jeffrey said.
Talk to it. Explain that you are Jeffrey Akinya and that you're prepared to submit to questioning to prove it.
Think that's going to work? Jemai asked him. Don't know. Any other bright ideas? Short of fighting our way past anti-collision systems. Those are basically guns, in case you missed the briefing.
Thank you, she replied. I do get the fact that there are real risks here.
I'm sorry, Jeffrey said. And he meant it, too. Of all the people he knew, it was hard to think of anyone less risk-averse than Jemai.
Look, she said, giving him a conciliatory look. If the construct says this is our best shot.
Are we still on air? Jeffrey asked.
Say your piece,
Gilbert confirmed. He cleared his throat. This is Jeffrey Akinya speaking again. I have no formal means of establishing my identity, not at this range, but I'm willing to talk. Eunice knew me, maybe not well, but as well as she knew anyone in our family.
If there's something, anything that I can say to prove myself, please ask. I will do my best to answer.
There was silence. Jumai opened her mouth to speak, but she had not even begun to draw breath when the habitat answered again.
Disengage all external comms except for this tight beam link. Any attempt to query the Org will be detected.
It's done, Arethusa said.
After a moment, the Winter Palace said, Wooden elephants, a birthday present. How many were there? And how old would Jeffrey Akinya have been when he received them?
He looked around at his fellow travelers. I would have been 5, 6, he mouthed, keeping his words low enough not to be picked up on the ship to station channel. I don't remember.
I saw those elephants, Jumai said, in the same hushed voice. You told me you didn't even think they'd come from Eunice.
There was a nanny from Djibouti looking after Sunday, and at the time, I thought maybe she'd got them, or maybe Memphis.
Ask the construct, Gilbert said. Can't. There's a copy of her assigned to me, like a cloud hovering around me in data space, but she's not inside my skull. Without the Org, she can't tell me anything.
I must have an answer, the habitat said. How old was Jeffrey Akinya?
6, he said. 6 elephants, and I was 6 at the time. My 6th birthday. Silence again. And then,
approach authorization granted. Proceed for docking at the trailing pole.
Jeffrey let out a gasp of bottled up tension. We're in. Or at least allowed a little closer.
How did you figure it out? 5 or 6?
Jumai asked.
I didn't. It was a guess. Lucky fucking guess.
She knew about the elephants, Jeffrey said, as much to himself as anyone present. She may not have bought them, but I didn't even think she cared enough to know.
Enough to make it the billion yuan question, Jumai said.
We're lined up, Mira Gilbert said. Still off Org, and we'll stay that way for the time being.
Then her tone changed.
Wait. Something's happening with the Kinyeti. Thruster activity.
Where's she headed? Jeffrey asked.
Give me a few seconds to nail the vector.
Gilbert watched and waited, tapping commands into her fold-out keyboard and studying the complex multicolored readouts as they squirmed through various scenarios.
Resumed her approach for the Winter Palace, she said, sounding doubtful of her own analysis. That can't be right, can it? He's only been in there, 20 minutes?
Maybe that's all he needs, Jumai said.
He still wouldn't want to call in the Kinyeti, Jeffrey said. Not when he has his own means of getting back. So maybe there's a problem with the ferry, or he's told the Kinyeti to block our approach to the other dock.
We have approach authorization, Arethusa said. If he blocks us, this becomes an interjurisdictional incident.
I think it already became one the moment I signed up for citizenship, Jeffrey said.
I'm slowing our own approach, Gilbert said. Want to see what the Kinyeti's aiming for before we get any closer.
Jeffrey reminded himself that he wasn't chinging here, his flesh and blood body safely back in Africa. He was physically present, aboard a huge, ponderous, fragile as gossamer machine, something that could no more tolerate a collision with another of its kind than it could execute dogfight course changes. And with 2 delicate ships being drawn to the candle flame of the Winter Palace, the chances of an accident, let alone a deliberate obstructional act, could only increase.
Kinyeti's 10Ks out, Gilbert said, a few minutes later. Looks as if they're lining up for the docking node where Hector's already clamped on. Does that make sense to anyone?
Might be the only entry point they trust, Jumai said.
Jeffrey nodded. Let's wait and see what their intentions are. A second or so later, Arethusa said,
Pirates.
She had seen it an instant before the rest of them, an eruption of pinprick light from either end of the habitat's cylinder, the bright spillage of magnetic and optical collision avoidance devices, as they directed mass and energy against whatever the Winter Palace's autonomous defense systems had identified as an incoming threat. Not an enemy, because the notion of enemy required the supposition of intent, of directed sentience, but rather something dumb and non-negotiable,
space debris or a marauding chunk of primeval rock and ice sailing too close for comfort. It took Geoffrey a moment to interpret Arethusa's statement. There were no pirates. But there were proximal impact ranging and target eradication systems. And in English, the acronym was precisely the word Arethusa had uttered. Guns, basically. But rigorously fail-safed, incapable of being directed at anything other than a real, imminent collision hazard. Non-weapons. They had stood down upon Hector's approach, but they had not shown the Kinyeti the same courtesy. A moment after he grasped what was happening, Geoffrey saw the flowering of multiple impact points along the Kinyeti's hull, attended by puffs of sudden silver brightness as metal and ceramics underwent instantaneous vaporization. The best the pirates could do was subject her to a continuous disruptive assault, aiming to break up her mass into smaller parts that could be individually bulldozed out of harm's way using further kinetic energy volleys. Most of the ship remained. One of her centrifuge arms had been ripped loose, cartwheeling away on its own new orbit, and all up and down her hull lay a peppering of craters and voids where she'd been struck. One of her fuel tanks had been punctured, and was now venting furiously, while there was evidence of systemic pressure loss from three or four rupture points in the forward module. The view was clouded by the debris and gases expanding away from the ship itself, cloaking her injuries. But she wasn't dead. They knew this when a second stutter of heat and light signaled the Kinyeti deploying her own anti-collision systems, this time in a coordinated strike against the habitat. Quite what the legality of that action was, Geoffrey couldn't begin to guess. The number of instances of ships being attacked by other ships, or stations by ships, or vice versa, was surely so small that there could be little or no precedent for it in modern law. That the Kinyeti was protecting herself was beyond dispute, but equally, her crew must have realized that the habitat would not permit a closer approach, and that their actions were provocative. From the Quainor, all they could do was watch, transfixed, as the conflict ran its course. The Kinyeti's assault had taken out the visible pirate emplacements ringed around either end of the Winter Palace. But the Winter Palace was rotating, and her slow spin brought undamaged emplacements into view. The palace fired again, blasting another fuel tank, nearly severing the main axis and doing further harm to the command module at the ship's front. The gas cloud thickened to grey-white smog. The Kinyeti retaliated, less convincingly this time, as if portions of her own defense systems had been damaged or rendered inoperable. Blast sites pockmarked the Winter Palace, some landing far from the end caps, cratering the unmarked skin of the cylinder, punching so far into insulation that they might have touched the bedrock of Eunice's private hothouse. The Winter Palace kept spinning, as heavy and oblivious as a grindstone. More pirates revolved into view and rained hell on the Akinya craft. There was a sputter of retaliation. Then nothing. The Winter Palace, largely undamaged even now, maintained its spin as the debris gas cloud slowly dispersed away from the wreck of the Kinyeti. The tattered, broken-backed mining ship was still moving, still on approach vector for the habitat. No further attacks were forthcoming.
Okay, would someone be so good as to clue me in on what the fuck just happened?
Jemai asks, doubtless rhetorically.
Hector must have called for help or he was late checking in, Geoffrey said.
Somewhere between his arrival and the point where it fired on the Kinyeti, the Winter Palace must have changed its mind about him being welcome. He sounded awed and appalled, even to himself, not quite able to process what he had just witnessed.
There could still be survivors, Gilbert said. I'm trying to establish direct comms.
Resuming org reach, we don't have much to lose now, and it may be our only way of establishing a path to the Kinyeti. The merwoman paused, rapt with concentration.
Oh, wait, here's something. General distress signal, point of origin, Kinyeti. She's calling for assistance.
Can you patch me through? Geoffrey asked.
No idea if they can still hear, but you can try. Speak when ready.
He coughed to clear his throat.
This is Geoffrey Akinya calling the Kinyeti. We saw what's just happened to you.
What is your status and how may we assist? The reply came through on voice-only comms, sounding as if it had been broken up, scrambled, and only partially reassembled.
This is Captain Dos Santos, a Kenya Space Mining Vehicle Kenyeri. We have sustained damage to critical systems, life support, inoperable.
It was a man's voice, speaking Swahili at source.
We can't steer, and we have no Delta V capability. Our emergency escape vehicle is detached.
They're screwed, Eunice said. We saw the departure, Jeffrey said, trying to tune out the construct, but not wishing to devoke her completely.
I presume Hector took the vehicle.
Captain Dos Santos hesitated. Jeffrey could imagine him wondering how much he was at license to disclose.
Yes, of course. I'm Hector's cousin, if you didn't already know.
Jeffrey glanced at one of Gilbert's readouts, trusting that he was interpreting it correctly.
It doesn't look as if you're going to smash into the Winter Palace now. Your vector puts you passing close to the docking hub, but avoiding an actual collision. That's lucky.
They must have vented enough gas to push them off course, Eunice said, but they're still at risk from my guns.
They're your guns. You turn them off, Jumai said.
I can't, dear.
We don't know how many of the Winter Palace's guns are still operable, Jeffrey said, cutting over the construct, and I doubt your information is any better than ours.
No, probably not.
The captain allowed himself a quiet, resigned laugh.
What do you suggest, Mr. Akinya?
We can't risk endangering this ship until you're out of immediate range of the Winter Palace, Jeffrey said. Once we're satisfied that those guns won't be turned on us, we'll close in for docking. You'll have to ride things out until then. How many of you are there?
8,
Dos Santos answered. Comms had stabilized now. His voice was coming through much more clearly and without dropouts.
That's the regular crew, myself included.
We can easily take 8 survivors, Gilbert said. It won't overburden our life support, and at most, we'll only need to hold them for a few hours before UON or lunar authorities arrive.
There's also Hector,
the captain added.
I was about to ask, Jeffrey said.
Hector was supposed to return on his own. We were never meant to get that close. Then he signaled for help.
He needed technical assistance, rescuing. Beyond that, I can't tell you anything. We think he may have been hurt, but that's just guesswork. We were on voice only. No ching and no biomed feed from his suit.
Dos Santos grunted, either effort or pain. It was impossible to tell which.
But he wouldn't have called unless there was a problem.
Okay, Jeffrey drew a breath, giving himself the space to collect his thoughts.
Are you in suits, Captain? Getting into them as we speak. Afterwards, we'll crawl into our storm cellar. That's the best armor part of the Kenyeti. Should be able to ride out the worst of it in there, even full depressurization. Whatever happens, help is on its way. I'm sorry you were dragged into this.
We did what we were asked to do, Dos Santos replied. That's all.
Good luck, Captain.
Same to you, Mr. Akinya. Dos Santos signed off.
Jeffrey remained silent for a few moments, wishing it did not fall on him to say what was surely on all their minds.
We can't leave him there, he said quietly. But at the same time, we can't endanger the Quenor. We also have a duty of care to the Kenyeti survivors.
If they make it through the close approach, they'll have nothing to fear,
Arethusa said.
Mira said it herself. The authorities will already have been alerted to the attack, and they'll be on their way very shortly indeed. In a few hours, maybe less, this volume of space will be crawling with enforcement and rescue services.
I'm just concerned for your safety, Jeffrey said.
If I wanted to be cocooned, I'd never have left Tiamat,
the old aquatic answered.
We have an advantage over the Kenyeti, anyway. We still have power and steering. Mira, I want you to take us all the way into the airlock we originally agreed to use, but in such a way you minimize our exposure to those pirate emplacements, which we suspect may still be operational. Can you do that?
Gilbert's hands danced on the keypads. I think so. Possibly. Whether the ship will take it, I don't know. We'll be stress-loading her to the max to match the habitat's spin.
They built safety margins into these things,
Arethusa answered. And I've allowed for the margins, Gilbert said.
Let me look at this, Eunice said. I may be able to help.
Are you serious? Geoffrey asked.
Totally. Vok me active Ching privilege. I need to drive your body.
No, he said, even before he'd begun to consider the implications of her request.
You think nothing of chinging into a golem when the mood suits you, nor would you object if another person wished to drive your body as a warm blood proxy. Why does my request offend you so very deeply?
He was about to say, because you're dead and you were my grandmother. But he stopped himself in time. The construct was a pattern of self-evolving data, nothing more. It embodied knowledge and certain useful skill sets. That it just happened to manifest with the body and voice of his late relative was totally immaterial. So he told himself. I don't know if Eunice can do a better job than any of us at flying this thing, he told the others. What she thinks she can do and what she can really do are not the same things.
I flew ships like this before you were a glint in your mother's eye, Eunice said. The avionics, the interfaces, they're as ancient and old-fashioned as me.
If she can do this, Jemai said.
We should use all available assets,
Arethusa concurred.
Mira, if you don't like what's happening, you can revoke Geoffrey's command privilege at any time, can't you?
Gilbert gave the merwoman equivalent of a shrug. More or less.
I'll accept the consequences. Geoffrey, I can't force you to do this, but you have my consent to fly the Quenor. If Eunice is able to help with that, so much the better.
You must do this, Eunice said. Her tone turned needling. You let elephants into your head, grandson. Surely you can make an exception for me.
Give me the controls, he said, popping his knuckles, spreading his fingers, loosening his shoulder muscles, just as if he was readying himself for an hour in the Cessna. Eunice, I'm letting you in. You know I can kick you out at any time, so don't overstay your welcome.
As if I'd ever do that.
He evoked the rarely given command, the one that assigned full, voluntary control of his own body to another intelligence. There was nothing magical about it. It was merely an inversion of the usual Ching protocols. Nerve impulses, running one way rather than the other. Sensory flow leaving his head rather than entering it. Still, it was strange for him. People did this sort of thing all the time, hiring out their bodies as warm blood proxies. He'd never had cause to ching into a warm blood himself. But if the situation had demanded it, and there'd been no other choice, he supposed he'd have accepted the arrangement without complaint. But the other way round, to be the warm blood. Never in a million years. And here he was being driven by his grandmother. She stole his eyes first. Between one moment and the next, they weren't looking where he wanted, but where she needed to see. And her intake of visual information was so efficient that it felt as if he had gone into a kind of quivering optic seizure, his eyeballs jerking this way and that in the manner of REM sleep. Then she took his hands. They started moving on the fold-out keypads, rap-tapping commands into the Quenor's avionics. It felt for an instant as if his hands were stuffed into enchanted gloves that forced his fingers to dance. Then she stole his voice. It still sounded like him. She could make him speak, but she couldn't alter the basic properties of his larynx.
I have an approach solution. It's imperfect, and it will still expose us to the Winter Palace's countermeasures. If we were to attempt to match her spin precisely, we'd break up inside 60 seconds. This is a compromise that gets us to the dock and minimizes our likelihood of suffering catastrophic damage. I will assume control all the way in and make any necessary adjustments as we go. Do I have authorization?
Do you need it? Gilbert asked.
I thought it best to ask first, child,
Do it,
Arethusa said. The acceleration came without warning, without a cushioning transition from zero G. To his horror and wonderment, Jeffrey realized that he could hear the engines, even in vacuum. They had been cranked up so high that something of their output, some phantom of undamped vibration, was propagating through the chassis of the ship, despite all the intervening layers of insulation and shockproofing. It sounded like a landslide or a stampede, and it made him very, very nervous. Red lights started flashing, master caution alarm sounding. The Quaenor was registering indignant objection to the punishment it was now enduring. It had served its human masters well. Why were they putting it through this?
She's holding, Eunice announced through Jeffrey's throat. But that was the easy bit.
The Quaenor had to execute a curving trajectory to match, or even come close to matching, the Winter Palace's spin. In the Cessna, it would have needed nothing more than a modest application of stick and rudder. But curvature was acceleration, and in vacuum, that could only be achieved by thrust, directed at an angle to the ship's momentary vector. The magnetoplasma engines could not be gimbaled, and therefore the Quaenor was forced to use auxiliary steering and maneuvering rockets pushed to their limits. Under such a load, the possibility of buckling was a very real risk. Jeffrey needed no sensors or master caution alarms to tell him that. He could feel it in the push of his bones against his restraints, the creaks and groans from his surroundings. When something clanged against the hull, he assumed it was the resumption of the Winter Palace's attack. But no, it was just a speck of debris from the wreckage of the Kinyeti. More came in drumming volleys, and then they were through the thickest part of it. The acceleration and steering thrust intensified and abated in savage jerks as Eunice finessed her approach solution. They were very close now, fewer than a dozen kilometers from the station, and the extent of its damage, or lack of it, was becoming much clearer. A fraction, maybe 1 in 5 of the pirate devices appeared unharmed. They wheeled slowly into view, and then slowly out of view again, like cabins in a Ferris wheel. Maybe we'll still have approach authorization, Jemai said. Something hit them. There'd been no warning, and they were so close to the Winter Palace that even a kinetic energy slug arrived almost instantaneously. The Quaenor shook and kept shaking as the energy of the impact whiplashed up and down her chassis. 2 or 3 seconds later, the habitat scored another strike. In the neurotic jitter of his vision, Jeffrey caught Mira Gilbert studying a schematic, an outline of the ship with damaged areas pulsing an angry red. He wanted to speak, wanted to ask how serious the injuries were, but Eunice still had him in her thrall. Then it quietened. There were no more impacts, and just as miraculously, the acceleration eased, smoothed, reduced to zero. They had transited the volume of maximum hazard. The Quaenor gave one more creak, and then all was silent. Even the master caution alarm had stopped blaring. We're clear, Eunice said. My guns can't touch us now. There's a zone of avoidance around either docking pole, and we're well inside it. Normal approach and docking will be completed in... She made a show of hesitation, although the answer was surely known to her in advance. 30 seconds? Please fold away your tray tables and place your seats in the upright position. Thank you for flying with Akinya Space. Why did you shoot at us? Gilbert asked. That wasn't shooting. That was a reminder not to take anything for granted. She made him let out a small, prideful sigh. Well, grandson, now that my work here is done, would you like your body back? His eyes stopped their jerky dance. He could speak again, and move his hands normally.
You did well, he said.
You feel the need to compliment me?
It's what Sunday would do, he said, addressing the now disembodied voice. That's all. Soon came a gentle clunk, followed by a quick sequenced drum roll of capture clamps, primed like the petals of some carnivorous plant, to lock onto any vehicle that made it this far. Jeffrey began to undo his restraints. It had been difficult, but they had docked with the Winter Palace. Now all they had to do was go inside
and see what had become of Hector.